Do we have a new agent to treat Clostridium difficile infection?
Detecting medical device safety.
Can sleep studies be done at home?
And speaking the language of diabetes.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. Posted on January 27th, 2017, I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And Rick, because you threatened me with pronunciations, I think we're going to turn first to a study taking a look at treatment of Clostridium difficile, a really serious, often life-threatening infection that people can get while they're in the hospital, and a new agent called bezlotoxumab that has some really impressive results. That's in the New England Journal of Medicine.
In high-income countries, C. diff is actually the most common cause of infectious diarrhea in hospitalized patients. It's associated with increased hospitalizations, sepsis, and death. Although it can be treated with antibiotics in up to 35% of individuals treated with antibiotics, it actually recurs or is actually not cured. This new therapy is not antibiotic, but it's actually an antibody directed toward the toxin associated with C. diff. These were two different studies in over 2,600 individuals that had C. diff infection. They all got treated with antibiotics, and then half of them got treated with antitoxin antibodies to either a toxin A or toxin B. We're going to talk primarily about toxin B because the antibody to toxin A didn't add any additional benefit. But those individuals that received antibiotics followed by a single IV infusion of the antitoxin antibodies had a 38% lower incidence of having recurrent C. diff. So this is big news.
It really is big news because, as I suggested, there's an awful lot of death that's relative to this infection.
Particularly in high-risk individuals. And who are those? The elderly individuals and those that have other comorbid diseases.
So this single infusion then was able to reduce the recurrence, wasn't it, by about 30%?
Actually, 38%.
So that is excellent news. What are your thoughts about how long it's going to take to deploy this stuff? And I'm wondering if there's any efficacy with more than one infusion.
Great questions. Let me address the first. This was the phase 3 trial. It was a large trial, 2,600 individuals, that showed remarkable efficacy and no significant side effects. So I think it'll be on the market fairly soon. Regarding your second question, can we get even better results by giving additional infusions? That remains to be seen. The other thing is, how does this compare with fecal transplant, and could these be complementary as well? So there's still a lot to be discovered, but the nice thing is this is a new therapy directed at a new target.
Great news. Since we're in NEJM then, let's stay there and let's turn to something that's near and dear to your heart as a member of the committee for the FDA who evaluates cardiac devices. This is a look at evaluating devices with this post-marketing surveillance after they're already out there and deployed.
The value of this particular study is less about the particular device and more about how we can use a registry to discover problems with the devices or to look at the efficacy between two different devices. So let me tee this up for a second. Most of the hospitals in the United States that perform PCI participate in what's known as the Cath PCI registry of the National Cardiovascular Data Registry. We put the data in on every single patient, what type of equipment we use and what the outcome is. Over the last several years, 2 million different procedures were entered into the database. Now fast forward. When these procedures are done, they're done through one of the arteries. When the procedure is over, there's a risk of bleeding from that artery. Oftentimes we use what are called vascular closure devices. Well, there was a hint that one of the closure devices may not be as safe as the others. How do you figure that out? Looking at the database of almost 2 million individuals, they identified 73,000 that had received this particular vascular closure device, and they compared them to another 73,000 that got a different device. And what they discovered was, although the risk of having complications was relatively low, that is about 1 to 2%, one device was clearly better than the other. Now, I'm not naming the devices because that's not where the meat is in this study. It's the fact that we use a registry, prospectively gathered data of almost 2 million individuals to drill down to look at a device that's relatively safe but has some complications and able to compare it to another. That's the value of this particular study.
This is certainly the big data kind of fruition that we were hoping for with gathering this kind of stuff. Didn't I hear or read one caveat that one of the problems with these registries is they're voluntary?
they are voluntary. You say, well, why would a hospital do it if it's voluntary? Well, because they have access to information as well, and they can compare their results compared to a national database to let them know how they're doing.
I just wonder if it would be even more beneficial if we rendered it compulsory.
And in fact, there are some compulsory databases. The percutaneous valves that we use, the hospitals that commit to that program have to commit to enter all their data. They're prospective, they're active, they're ongoing, and the data we get from them is very valuable.
More on that, I'm sure. Let's turn from here to something that's an intervention that's a little bit different in JAMA Internal Medicine. Gosh, if folks are language concordant, that is, they speak the same language, does that improve control in type 2 diabetes, this specifically in the Latino population?
This was actually conducted as a part of the Kaiser network. They obviously have a number of individuals, particularly in California, that are Spanish-speaking. Now, they're assigned or register to receive their primary care from doctors that may either be Spanish-speaking or non-Spanish-speaking. And what the authors wondered was, does speaking the same language influence the ability to control somebody's diabetes? They identified individuals who were assigned to somebody that did not speak Spanish, that is, they were language discordant, and they looked at those individuals over a 12-month period to see how well their diabetes was controlled. Then they looked at the next 12 months. Some of those individuals stayed with physicians that didn't speak Spanish, and some switched to physicians that did speak Spanish. And what they discovered is, compared to individuals that stayed with physicians who didn't speak Spanish, those that switched to someone that spoke their native language had better control of their diabetes. They were more likely to have a hemoglobin A1C of less than 8, 10 absolute percentage points better, and they were less likely to have a hemoglobin A1C over 9. 4% fewer individuals had poorly controlled diabetes. Good evidence that facilitating language concordance can be helpful in controlling chronic diseases.
And I'm just betting that for everyone else who has language discordance, this is also important. And we've discussed previous data that took a look even at ethnicity, suggesting that African Americans who see African American physicians are also more compliant.
That increases patient satisfaction, it increases patient trust, and with regard to language, it also increases the ability of the doctor to talk about treatments, diet, and exercise. So you're right, developing culturally sensitive and language concordant primary care providers is incredibly important.
And that's about all we can say about that one, I think. Finally, then, let's turn to Annals of Internal Medicine. Can sleep studies be safely and informatively done at home?
Because of the obesity epidemic and the increasing recognition of obstructive sleep apnea as a condition contributing to hypertension and heart disease, there's been a plethora of sleep studies being performed. In fact, third-party payers are recognizing a number of individuals are recommended to undergo overnight sleep studies. That's a tremendous cost. It's also a burden to individuals. So it would be nice if we could determine whether home sleep studies were just as effective. So the investigators looked at 400 individuals, all of whom underwent the overnight sleep studies. In addition, they were randomized to either receive a home sleep study using very similar equipment, looking at airflow, muscle movement and how somebody slept and monitoring their EKG and oxygen saturation, or a more limited version of that where they only looked at the heart rate and oxygen saturation. And then they asked, how reliable are they and can we use those to guide treatment with CPAP and how do people feel? And what they discovered was the full home sleep studies were just as effective as the overnight sleep studies. In some instances where they combined that with CPAP that was auto-titrated, it was even more effective. Now, the more limited version that only looked at heart rate and oxygen saturation, not so good. It had a harder time making the correct diagnosis and therefore is more difficult to give the right therapy. I think this has the potential for expanding the appropriate use of sleep studies and doing it in a way that can drive down the cost and increase availability as well.
Let's talk just a little bit about some of the mechanics of this. Does this mean that some technician comes and hauls in all the equipment and says, okay, this is how you're going to get all electroded up before you go to bed, and then something else records it and then they come and collect that?
It does require a little bit of training. There's no question about that. The nice thing about it is that can be done in a more limited amount of time than an overnight sleep study and whenever it's convenient for somebody. Furthermore, once you make the diagnosis, it still requires the appropriate education about how to manage your CPAP. the continuous positive airway pressure machine that's very effective. And for these auto titrations, to teach them how to use it so that the CPAP can actually gauge someone's sleep apnea and automatically adjust. Those were better in a post hoc analysis than the routine overnight sleep studies and just fixed CPAP therapy.
Good news, everyone likes convenience, I think. On that note, I'm going to talk about the bezalituximab this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.